Good evening. I'm Richard Sennett, professor of sociology here at the LSE. And I am very pleased to invite you to welcome you to this lecture this evening by Seymour Martin Lipset with a commentary by George Walden. Those of you who are my students have been reading Seymour Martin Lipset, and perhaps too much. You know, all of you, I think, that he is one of the most distinguished political scientists and political observers in the United States. He is a man who has written about the intersection of politics and social structure, and also about the intersection between political ideology and political history. For those of you who are my students, you know him as a writer on the American right in such books as Political Man. He also has a long-standing interest and has conducted a great deal of research on the history of the American left. He's written on agrarian socialism, and his most recent book, It Didn't Happen Here, is his study of why socialism did not take root in the United States. And the LSE has asked him if he'd speak a little about some of the themes in that book. We thought it would be interesting, since Professor Lipset's work makes an argument, if not for the uniqueness, at least for the exceptionalism of American political experience in relation to that of Europe, to have a commentary by someone who, a European, who might have a somewhat different view on the fortunes of the left. And we could think of no one better than George Walden, whom, as most of you know, is a diplomat, a politician, and a writer, whose most recent book is called The New Elites, Making a Career in the Masses. This is an evening that we will conduct, as we always do, with a 50-minute presentation by our speaker, with 5 or 10 minute commentary by George Walden. There'll then be questions from the floor, and I live in hope that someday at one of these lectures I can actually hear somebody ask a question, a request for more information, and perhaps you'll gratify me with that desire tonight. And after a few questions, you're all cordially invited to go upstairs for a brief reception. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome my friend and colleague, Seymour Martin Lipset, to speak to you this evening.
Thank you very much, Dick. I'm very pleased to be back here at LSE. I've never had the opportunity, as Richard Sennett has, to teach here, but I've given lectures over the years. Not one recently, but I go back pretty far. And I'm glad that one of the faculty in sociology, when I gave a lecture in some distant past, Julius Gould is here tonight. Of course, there were all sorts of people, both in sociology and in government, whom I knew who are retired or departed, like Bob McKenzie, who was a great political scientist, or Donald McRae, who was a great sociologist. The United States, as was noted by Alexis de Tocqueville, and also should be noted by Friedrich Engels, is an exceptional country. That term, by the way, was coined, or at least first applied to the United States by Tocqueville back in his Democracy in America, meaning by that it was uniquely different in its organizing principles and social class structure from the more traditional, status-bound, post-feudal nations of the old world. The term American exceptionalism has been used, as Tocqueville did, in a general comparative analysis but it became widely applied as a term after World War I in efforts to account for the weakness of working class radicalism and class awareness in the United States. The communists particularly got interested in the problem, not that they were against it, but the American Communist Party for a while tried to insist that the United States was different and that the kind of party line that was being pursued by the Communist International and other countries wouldn't work in America. This, of course, was not a doctrine which Joseph Stalin could accept, since if one did, then the whole rationale for a centralized, controlled Communist International would disappear. But the question, and I want to talk about political exceptionalism, not sociological exceptionalism in a sense, the question has been, why did the United States, alone among industrialized countries, lack a significant socialist or a movement or a labor party? Now, this was an issue that bedeviled socialist theorists and writers from the late 18th century on. Engels tried to answer it in the last decade of his life. The German socialist, then socialist, and sociologist Werner Zumbart dealt with it in a major book published in German in 1906, entitled Why Is There No Socialism in the United States? The question was also addressed in that same year by H.G. Wells in a book called The Future in America. Both Lenin and Trotsky were deeply concerned with the phenomenon, for it questioned the logic of Marxism and Marxist historical materialism, as expressed by Marx himself in the preface to Das Kapital. And in that preface, depending on your edition, on pages 7 or 8, Marx said, the country that is more developed shows to the less developed the image of their future. That's a statement which flowed from historical materialism, namely that the technological and economic base gave rise to a socialist, to a superstructure, the superstructure including values, political systems, philosophy, and the like. And hence, the most developed country would have the most developed social structure, superstructure. And of course, there's no questioning the fact that from the last quarter of the 19th century on, the most developed country has been the United States. And that raised an interesting and important problem for the Marxists, which they were very conscious of. Namely, that if the United States was the most industrialized capitalist country, it should lead, logically, Marxism anticipated that it would lead the world into socialism. Zumbart emphasized the proposition, if modern socialism follows it as a necessary reaction to capitalism, the country with the most advanced capitalist development, namely the United States, would at the same time be the one providing the classic case of socialism, and its working class would be supporters of the most radical of socialist movements. This position became entrenched in Orthodox Marxism until World War I. While still a Marxist, before he became the most influential revisionist of Marxist ideas, Edward Bernstein's noted, we see modern socialism enter and take root in the United States in direct relation to the spread of capitalism and the appearance of a modern proletariat. Karol Kautsky, who was considered the leading theoretician in the German party, announced it in 1902, America shows us our future insofar as any one country can reveal it at all to another. And he elaborated this view in a book in 1910. August Bebel, who was the political leader of the German Social Democrats, stated unequivocally in 1907, Americans will be the first to usher in a socialist republic. In 1912, when the German Social Democrats got 110 seats in the Reichstag, about a third, and the American Socialists had one member of Congress, Bebel repeated this, that we have to study the United States to find out what socialism would be like. And Marx's son-in-law, Paul Lafarge, also stated this. Well, I could go on with dozens and dozens of Marxist, major Marxist theorists who enunciated this doctrine. And the continued inability of socialists to create a viable movement in the United States became a major embarrassment to Marxist theorists, since they assume that the superstructure of a society, which encompasses political behavior, is a function of the underlying economic and technological system. There was a man named Max Beer who worked for the Socialist International for 4 or 5 decades, and he wrote an autobiography in which he described how when socialist leaders in Europe got together at international meetings, they would, in private, discuss in very worried terms the fact that the United States didn't have a significant socialist movement. Not because, or simply because, as socialists they would like to see it in the United States, but because they recognized the theory demanded it. And if it didn't happen, if it didn't wasn't occurring, maybe there was something wrong with the theory. And Beer suggests that they had this explicit notion. Now, it's interesting to note that Leon Trotsky took cognizance of Marx's statement in a 1939 publication intended for a popular American audience. He reiterated the sentence from Capital and then simply dismissed it in his next sentence, in his next line, with the comment, "Only no, under no circumstances can this be taken literally." Well, Trotsky knew his Marxism, understood that the theory demanded the U.S. should become socialist. Now, the fact that Trotsky brought this up in 1939 and then dismissed it suggests to me that it was much on his mind, that he understood, as earlier Marxists had, that if the United States didn't have a significant socialist movement, maybe there was something wrong with Marxist historical materialist analysis. In spite of, now I would argue, or I'm going to argue, that in spite of the sorry record of organized socialism in America, it may be argued that Marx was right, that the most developed country shows to the less developed the image of their future. But applying this generalization as an apolitical Marxism, not assuming that socialism is where developed industrialized countries are going to, you can argue that the never-feudal United States has been the prototype of a bourgeois society. As Max Weber understood, it became the most productive country precisely because its culture most thoroughly encompassed capitalist values, a point which was also made by Antonio Gramsci. The ideal capitalist, the ideal type capitalist for Weber was an American, Benjamin Franklin. The spirit of capitalism was most encompassed in American values. Now, the argument that American non-socialist politics would become the model for the European left, that is, that instead of Europe becoming social, the United States becoming socialist, that Europe would become like the United States, that where Europe was heading, if it was becoming more of a capitalist country, less of a post-feudal society, was that it would become Americanized. Not because it was imitating America, but because the underlying social structure of Europe was becoming like the United States. And this theory was, interestingly enough, presented in full flower in 1940 by Lewis Corey, who was an early leader of the American Communist Party. He broke with them and who had written a number of important Marxist books in the 30s. Lewis Corey, writing in 1940, said, "Rather than being an exception, America was actually the model for the capitalist countries. Only the positions in the race have been changed. European socialists could see in America the image of their own unhappy future. Far from being a unique or even a slightly different case, America was the prototype for capitalism. But in a curious reversal of roles, it was now the European socialists who could look across the ocean to see the future of their own movement. American development was not different than Europe. It was mainly in a more advanced stage." And as Lewis Corey anticipated, the lefts of other Western countries have increasingly become like the American socialist left. Your director, that is the director of the school, has written a number of books which in effect argue this, not in the terms which I'm presenting, but basically that the third way, that capitalism is now the wave of the future for all countries. And if I may quote from his first book on the subject, said, "No one any longer has any alternatives to capitalism. The arguments that remain concern how far and in what ways capitalism should be governed and regulated." And of course, the U.S. was, to say, the first one. To a greater or lesser degree, all the socialist parties, not just most of them, reject statist economies and accept competitive markets as the way to grow and raise standards of living. The social democratic and labor parties are now socially and ideologically pluralistic. As I've noted, there's been a serious discussion among them about this need to recognize the difference. Blair, Jospin, Schroeder, and others have in effect reconstituted the Socialist International into a new grouping of progressive left parties in which the Democratic Party represents the United States. As long as it was a Socialist International, the Democrats couldn't represent the United States. Now that there's no longer a Socialist International, but there is an international of social democratic, labor, and progressive parties, the American Democratic Party is in it. The change in the character of the European parties reflects in large part a transformation of economic and class structures, one which moves them to resemble the United States as described by Tocqueville and also various pre-World War I Marxists. The emphasis on Stände, fixed explicitly hierarchical social classes derived from a feudal and monarchical past, has declined greatly, if not disappeared. The growth in the economies with a resultant considerable increase in consumption goods and the more equitable allocation of education has greatly reduced the differences in styles of life, including accents and dress, among the social classes. For reasons I don't completely understand, the country which remains the most post-feudal, though it has changed a great deal, is this one, the one you're living in, which I'm lecturing in right now. The distribution of income and occupational skills has changed from a pyramidal shape enlarging towards the bottom, which characterized the late 19th and early 20th century, to one that resembles a diamond bulging in the middle. Left political parties now seek to appeal more to the growing middle class than to the industrial workers and the impoverished, who are declining proportionally. In the United States, the prototype of structural development in industrialized societies, the proportion of those employed in non-manual pursuits has increased from 43% in 1960 to 58% at the end of the century. Workers in manufacturing have fallen from 26% to 16%. Corresponding drop-offs for the United Kingdom were from 36% to 16%. In Sweden, from 32% to 19%. For the Netherlands, 30% to 19%. For Australia, 26% to 13%. They've been less dramatic in France and Germany, but even there, the direction has been the same. And this, of course, means that the kind of social environment that Marx anticipated or hoped would produce socialists has become less and less significant. The American system has always placed a lesser emphasis on class awareness and organization than the European societies. In any case, they've been declining in both sides of the Atlantic. Union membership, the predominant base of the left parties, has fallen in proportionate terms in four-fifths of the 92 countries surveyed by the International Labor Organization. Between 85 and 95, density declined 21% in the United States. As of this moment, only 14% of employed American workers are union members. The high point was after the war, when it was about 35%. In private employment, only less than 10% are union members in the US. The losses in density in proportionate terms in France and Britain have been even greater. 37% for France, 28% for the United Kingdom, Germany fell off by 18%, and so on. And like the Democrats, the American Democratic Party, the European and Australasian Social Democratic parties have become more socially heterogeneous in membership and support. The correlations between class, economic position, and vote choice, lower in the United States than elsewhere in the industrial world, have been declining in the more developed countries in recent decades, that is, in the countries of Europe and Japan, as the distribution of economic class and of consumption levels have been changing. Some of the underlying forces giving rise to these developments have been specified by a number of neo-Marxist social scientists in discussing the emergence of post-industrial society, post-materialism, and the scientific technological revolution. Daniel Bell, a lifelong social democrat, has been the central figure in conceptualizing these changes in the West. Radovan Richter and his colleagues in the then Czechoslovakian Academy of Science before 1970 projected similar developments in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. The consequent changes in class and political relations within industrialized developed societies, much like the shifts in the politics of the left between the United States and Europe, can be analyzed in the framework of an apolitical Marxism, that is, accepting the proposition that technological structures and the distribution of economic classes determine the political and cultural superstructures, without assuming that socialism will succeed capitalism. Many of the trends anticipated by Marx, a steady increase in the industrial proletariat, a decline in self-employment incumbent in the growth of factories, have ended. Tertiary technological and service occupations, rather than production jobs, have been increasing rapidly. The number of students in higher education and university graduates has grown many times. Alan Touraine, a leading French sociologist and left intellectual, suggests that the basis of power has changed as a result of these developments. To quote him, if property were the criterion of membership, in the former dominant class, the new dominant class is defined by knowledge and a certain level of education. That argument, of course, was developed by Daniel Bell as well in his post-industrial society and by the Czech social scientists who were focusing on this. The neo-Marxist and technologically determinist scholars have stressed the extent to which theoretical and scientific knowledge has become the principal source of social and economic change, altering social structures, values, and mores in ways that have given considerable prestige and power to the scientific technological elites. The emerging strain of post-industrialism, whose roots are in the university, the scientific and technological worlds, heavily represented in the industry spawned by computers, the public sectors, and the professions, have developed their own distinctive values. Ronald Engelhardt, the most important empirical analyst of post-industrialism, points out that beyond the impact of technological innovations, the post-materialist value changes and the decline of class conflict are also a function of the growing climate of affluence in the last half century. The generations that came of age during the second half of the 20th century hold different values from previous cohorts. The latter were reared in an atmosphere of economic scarcity and experienced severe economic depressions. Survey data gathered by Engelhardt and others over the past quarter of a century have shown clear generational effects, as well as links to the massive growth in educational attainments, which have made the expansion in high-tech and scientific pursuits possible. These developments have profoundly affected the political scene and the industrial advance that is post-industrial North American, European, Australasian, Japanese societies. Post-industrial societies' politics have been marked by a decline in ideological conflict over the role of the state, accompanying the growth of market power in economic terms. A better educated citizenry has resulted in increasing concern with non-economic or social issues, the environment, health, the quality of education, the culture, greater equality for women and minorities, the extension of democratization and freedom at home and abroad, and last but far from least, a highly controversial, more permissive morality, particularly as affected family affairs and sexual behavior. In some polities, environmental reformers have taken the lead in creating new green parties, generally allied with the old left, or in the way to being aligned with the old left. It is notable that much as the United States set a model for less status and more market-oriented politics, more recently it has been in the forefront of post-materialist new politics, which have traveled, so to speak, from Berkeley and Madison to Paris, London, and Berlin. The French political analyst Jean-François Revel, writing in the early 70s, noted that the revolutionary strivings of the 60s have had their origin in the United States. The newer forms of movement protest, whether in Europe or elsewhere, are, to quote Revel, imitations of the American prototype, or extensions of and subsequent to it. European dissenters are the disciples of the American movements. Many political analysts, while recognizing major reformulations on the left within their own country, do not realize the extent to which these changes reflect common developments throughout the economically developed democracies, but they cannot be explained by specific national developments or leaders. To point up the magnitude and consequence of these events, I've tried to summarize the ways in which left politics in country after country have taken an American path. This, of course, does not mean that parties and ideologies are the same cross-nationally. Every country is different in exceptionalism and exceptional. Necessarily, there are important variations reflecting diverse histories, the varying nature of political cleavages, and structural and democratic patterns which underlie them. But the similarities among the polities, as Tony Blair once stressed, are considerable. As he noted, it is a perfectly healthy thing if we realize that there are common political developments the whole world over. The record suggests that the United States has become less exceptional politically, as the European societies and social democrats began to resemble the American democrats. And to say I've gone through a lot of this literature or material on it, and I'll cite a few. Tony Blair, for example, said in 1998, "In the economy, our approach is neither laissez-faire nor one of state interference. The government's role is to promote macroeconomic stability, develop tax and welfare policies that encourage independence, not dependence. to equip people for work by improving education and infrastructure and to promote enterprise. We are proud to be supported by the business leaders as well as trade unions. And perhaps in this context, it might be worth noting parenthetically that a month before your last elections, Margaret Thatcher, in an interview with Paul Johnson, that was published, I think, in the Globe and Mail, said Britain will be safe in the hands of Mr. Blair, which I think was not hard to recognize signal to some of her followers. The 1997 election won overwhelmingly by the Labour Party after it rejected its historic emphasis on public ownership, basically put a period, an end to a century of socialist efforts to sharply reduce or eliminate private ownership of the economy. Tony Blair has deliberately stressed his agreements with the free market, smaller government policies of Bill Clinton. Even before Clinton, though Clinton's got more credit, Blair proclaimed the era of big government is over. He promised to govern from the center, and he reformulated, as you know, his image of New Labour as a non-socialist party, and has emphasized that he wants unions to cooperate with business and management. Peter Mendelssohn, who was his, perhaps still is his ideologist, has proudly asserted that Labour is now a market capitalist party. Even more as notable is Blair's advice to the trade unions in a 1994 article in the New Statesman, which somehow not appeared in much of the literature, in which Blair wrote, this was an issue of the New Statesman on trade unions, and Blair wrote an article on the trade unions and politics, in which he said, and I quote, "It is in the union's best interest not to be associated with one political party." He argued that unions should be able to thrive with any change of government or no change of government. This by the leader of a party largely founded by the unions. In effect, Blair was giving the arguments against the commitment to a party put forth by Samuel Gompers, the founding president of the American Federation of Labor. Blair was saying Sam Gompers was right when he told American workers that they shouldn't get involved with a political party, with the Socialist Party. And there are various things which you know better than I, up the way Blair has moved or has represented this, a move of the party to the right and to work with business, to jump right after the last election here, I ran across a statement by a Warburg banker in which he said, now everything's fine. It's no longer socialists against capitalists. It's Democrats against Republicans. That was his description of what has happened to British politics. As Tony Blair has emphasized, the same pattern is evident the world over. During the 1980s, the Labour governments of Australia and New Zealand cut income taxes, pursued economic deregulation, and privatized various industries. The Australian Party made an accord with trade unions that resulted, as the then Prime Minister Robert Hawke noted, in reducing real wages by at least 1% in each of the 8 years in which he was head of the government. He boasted of this, that the effect of labor had been to cut wages 1% a year. And he stressed that the move in the share of the nation's income from wages towards profits has enabled the economy to grow. The New Zealand story is similar, and some people have even described the New Zealand laborites as Thatcherites. But the story can be reiterated for left parties outside the English-speaking world. The Swedish Social Democrats, who were a long time the prototype Social Democratic Party, held office from the early 1950s on, with brief interludes out of power in 76 to 82 and again 94 to 98, reversed their previous wage growth, high income tax, and strong welfare state orientations, and undertook several privatization measures as well. The late American socialist leader and theorist Mike Harrington, who studied them with the Swedish Social Democrats, noted critically that the Social Democratic government under Prime Minister Palmer reduced the real income of those with a job while increasing unemployment, much as Hawke did in Australia. In Spain, before he left office, the socialist Prime Minister Felipe González inaugurated a number of policies, but I won't go into detail on them, but it led the economist to describe the Spanish policies as Thatcherite. The first major Marxist party in the world, the Social Democrats of Germany, rejected Marxism perhaps earlier than any of the others at its Bad Godesberg's conference in 1959. And again, it stressed that free economic competition was one of the essential conditions for a social democratic economic policy. Speaking in 1976, Chancellor Helmut Schmidt precursored the Australian Labor Prime Minister in arguing that the interests of the workers required expanding profits, noting that the profits of enterprise today are the investments of tomorrow, and the investments tomorrow are the employment of the day after. The SPD's 1990 program noted in classical liberal fashion, that within a democratic established setting, the market and competition are indispensable. In 1995, the then social democratic, German social democratic candidate for chancellor, and currently, I think he's still the chairman of the European Socialist Group, Rudolf Scharping, emphasized that his party's historic assumptions have been proven wrong. He simply said that. He said, we social democrats have to admit we've been wrong for 50 years, that we've created an overly regulated, overly bureaucratic, overly professionalized welfare state. And over, among other problematic policies, he pointed to Social Security and a number of other things, wastes in public money. And of course, Gerhard Schroeder, who became chancellor in 98, proclaimed not the new middle, and the new middle is very much like the sorts of things which Blair and the others have done. In his inaugural speech after being inducted as chancellor, Schroeder stressed continuity with the previous Kohl government, saying we do not want to do everything differently, but many things better, and then called for cutting taxes and so on. In the past, social democratic parties created extensive welfare states that required a steadily increasing proportion of the gross national product, in some cases reaching over half of the gross national product going to the government. Today, however, the same parties recognize that they simply cannot compete on the world market unless they reduce government expenditures. Their electoral situation also has pressed them to look for the support of the middle class and of the skilled workers and high-tech employee voters. Hence, like Blair and Schroeder, they all seek to lower taxes, to reduce welfare entitlements, and balance their budget, and also pressing for various post-materialist reforms involving cleaning up the physical, social, and economic environment, involving the policies of the Greens. And you can find this in the prototype social democratic country of Sweden. In fact, the only current exception to the move away from state intervention among socialist parties is Norway, which still favors extensive welfare policies, but it should be noted, not nationalization of industry. And Norway, of course, can retain its belief in old-fashioned socialism because of its abundant oil resources, which pay for welfare, for the welfare state. And the French have been seen to some degree as an exception, only partially because France is the most statist country in Europe in terms of its history and philosophy. And as one student of French politics noted, it was difficult for the French socialists to move to the right of the French conservatives, because the French conservatives remained in a considerable degree status. But even there, I think the record of Lionel Jospin has involved a shift to the right. One of the interesting things about him in relation to the United States was that he took a trip to the United States on his own after he was prime minister to look at the American economy. And he came back and said, we've been tricked by the left, that is by the left intellectuals. Because we've known that the United States has created many more jobs than Europe, tens of millions, while Europe created very few. But he says, we were told that these were bad jobs, low-paid jobs, unskilled jobs. And he said, it isn't true, that most of the new jobs in the United States have been well-paid, requiring education and skill. And that we therefore have to learn a great deal from Americans' economic dynamism. Curiously, the model late 1990s country frequently cited as such by European social democrats and others is the Netherlands, with an unemployment rate of 6% in 97, below the major continental economies, and a growth rate higher than in Britain, France, and Germany. The Dutch, under a government headed by a former union leader, Wim Kok of the Labour Party, has kept down wages, inflation, and interest rates, and has stimulated private business. It's cut unemployment benefits, while rules for sick and disability pay have been tightened. And this again has been seen as being more in the direction of Thatcher than of traditional social democratic policies. In the Netherlands, the unions, led by Kok before he became prime minister, and the employers signed a social pact, which was similar to the Australian Accord that was signed by labor and business, in which the labor agreed that it would limit wage increases to 2% a year. Well, whether produced by these policies or not, Holland got full employment earlier than everybody else in Europe. Therefore, if you look at this record, you could say far from the politically backward United States following the lead of the more progressive Europe, as socialists anticipated and hoped, the old country left, the old world left, is now becoming more like the American, as Lewis Corey had anticipated. Hence, it may be reiterated that in political terms, the United States has shown Europe the image of its future, as Marx anticipated it would. But this reflects the fact that the latter countries, the European countries, have also reached new heights of affluence and mass consumption, that they begin, as Antonio Gramsci anticipated, to resemble the United States, socially less stratified, less status-bound, and much better educated. Consequently, they are less privileged strata, are much less class-conscious than that earlier. It's again, parenthetically interesting to read Gramsci on America, because Gramsci said explicitly, before Europe can become socialist, it has to be Americanized. And what he meant by that is it has to get rid of all the feudal remnants. It has to become a pure market capitalist economy, which industrializes, which Marx also anticipated was a necessary precondition for socialism. And hence, this is what he anticipated. The United States, therefore, is no longer as exceptional politically. Like other developed countries, it is divided among socially more conservative or traditional groupings, which in the U.S. are libertarian, anti-statist, our historic anti-statist tradition, religious-based factions, environmental and other post-industrial tendencies, and anti-elitist popular segments. The strength and organizational forms of these anti-elitist popular segments vary from country to country, but none of them is socialist or seriously class-oriented. The now non-socialist progressive labor parties seek to make capitalism more humane and more efficient. As the advisor of François Mitterrand, Régis Debray, pointed out, the objective of, and he was also an advisor and supporter of Fidel Castro, it might be noted, but Debray noted that the objective of European socialist leaders is, and I quote him, to carry out the politics of the right, but more intelligently and in a more rational manner. Well, you can say this is what the American Democrats, in a sense, not in those terms, hope to do. America, however, it should be recognized, still remains as an outlier at one end of many international indices of behavior and values. The United States, American exceptionalism in sociological and political terms has not disappeared because this difference on socialism. It has higher rates of mobility into elite positions than any other country. A larger proportion of its young people attend university, particularly graduate and professional schools and elsewhere, making upward mobility into the elite more possible. The economy is not just the most productive, it is the greatest job producer by far in the developed world. From the end of World War II to the present, the American economy has created many more jobs than the entirety of Europe and Japan. And as Jospin has noted, these have not been bad jobs, but good jobs. Or at least, they've been all kinds of jobs, but in proportionate terms. The comparative picture, of course, is not as positive for the United States in other dimensions. American exceptionalism, as I noted in a book I wrote on the subject somewhat before, is double-edged. The country leads in the proportion of who don't vote in national elections. As one can anticipate, I'm not sure I can predict who's going to win the election next Tuesday, but I think I can predict that the turnout's going to be probably lower than ever. The numbers watching the debates were lower than ever. The American prison population is greater in per capita terms than elsewhere in the developed world, as are rates of violence. The nation is among the leaders in the unequal distribution of monetary income. The gap between that received by the upper 1 to 5% income group and the lowest 5 to 20% is greater than in most of Europe and Japan, though it's been growing in these countries also. This development, it should be noted, is largely, I think, and I think there's evidence to this, a result of the shift from factory to high-tech jobs, which rewarded educated labor while depreciating the level of wages of less skilled manual and service workers, many of whom in the United States are Latino and immigrants or African Americans, while in much of Europe they're immigrants from the South as well. Functional illiteracy is, of course, higher in the United States than in Europe and Japan. So that, you know, we're exceptional in good things, we're exceptional in bad things. And one can trace together some of the determinants of this. I tried to do this in my book, American Exceptionalism. If you're curious, you might take a look at that. And many of these cross-national differences parallel variations in public attitudes. Even if the United States, even if the difference between socialist and non-socialist politics doesn't exist anymore, there still is a difference with relation to welfare policies, to what if you want to call social democratic attitudes. There's a myriad of public opinion polls which have been done in many countries, and these countries show consistently that Americans are more likely to justify inequality. They're more likely to believe that large differences in income are necessary for a country's prosperity. They support differentiated pay structures. A review of public opinion data over 50 years reports that surveys since the 1930s have shown that the explicit idea of income redistribution elicits very limited enthusiasm among the American public. It gets much more support in Europe. And not surprisingly, the world value studies, which have been conducted in many countries from 1980 and 1990, reveal that social democratic attitude of values are still much stronger in Europe and Canada than in the United States. They report, for example, that when asked to choose between the importance of equality of income or the freedom to live and develop without hindrance, Americans are much more favorable than Europeans to the latter option. Americans are also more likely than Europeans to say taxes are too high for middle-income individuals, even though the taxes are, in fact, lower. The United States, in spite of what our Republican candidates say, has the lowest taxes in the developed world, and the government takes less in proportionately in, out of the gross national product than in other countries. In spite of the shifts towards approval of a free market by European leftists, government remains much more involved in the society and economy than in the United States, differences which have a long history. Americans are more prone to believe that they live in a meritocracy. The greater American commitment to opportunity is also, I think, reflected in the findings that citizens in the United States have been more disposed than Europeans to favor increased expenditures for education. In fact, the one area of government expenditure in which Americans have consistently led is on the idea of spending more money on education. And we do, in fact, spend proportionally more on education than in other the patterns. Contemporary America is the outcome of processes which began with a meritocratic and individualistic revolution, or egalitarian one. The United States remained through the 19th and early 20th centuries the closest example of a classically liberal society that rejected the assumptions of a script of elitism, of statism, of Tory noblesse oblige, a la Bismarck and Disraeli. One should recall that conservatism in Europe and in Britain meant something very different from conservatism in the United States, where it's meant, particularly in recent decades, libertarian or anti-statist ideologies. European conservatives, Tories, believed in noblesse oblige, in communitarianism. It was now, Margaret Thatcher is an American conservative, but Harold Macmillan once defined Toryism as paternalistic socialism. And you have a whole history of conservative leaders in Europe and in Britain, from Disraeli and Bismarck on, who in effect supported this kind of what Macmillan called paternalistic socialism. The main variables which reduced the potential for socialism and class consciousness in pre-World War II America were the anti-statist value systems, the socially more egalitarian social class structure, and the individualistic Protestant sectarian orientation in religion. The emphasis on egalitarian social relations, the absence of a demand that those lower in the social order give deference to their social or economic superiors, the stress on meritocracy and equal opportunity for all to rise socially and economically stem from an exceptional past and present. The country is characterized by the absence and hostility to hereditary privilege of an ascriptively legitimated upper class and fixed lower classes derivative from feudalism, and from the fact, of course, that America was formed as a new settler society, as well as the elaboration of the revolution-born libertarian and egalitarian ideology. Tocqueville noted these elements in 1830. He was, of course, aware of enormous variations in income and power, and of the strong emphasis on the attainment of wealth. But he stressed that regardless of steep economic inequalities, Americans do not require the lower strata to acknowledge their inferiority, to bow to their betters, that America was not a different society. Society and politics have, of course, changed greatly in America as in Europe. The 1930s produced a qualitative difference from the previous eras and produced a kind of Europeanization for the while in American politics, with the introduction of the welfare state to deal with the Depression. Class factors became more important in voting. But much of this disappeared in the United States, or declined, I shouldn't say disappeared, with the post-war era of relative prosperity characterizing the economy and society. Well, to what extent is it still possible to speak of American exceptionalism? It's obvious that the United States and the rest of the world has changed dramatically over the past two centuries. These countries have all become more productive, industrialized, urbanized, and better educated. The central state has become more powerful. As I've noted, the post-feudal elements that existed in many European countries have declined enormously. In social structural terms, the latter are becoming more like America. I can quote in this respect the previous director of yours, Ralph Dahrendorf, who once told me the way he was expelled from the Social Democratic Party of Germany. He was a hereditary Social Democrat. His father had been a leader. But he gave a speech at the invitation of Ollenhauer, who was then leader of the party, at a campaign rally, in which he said that the big problem of Germany was that it had never been a liberal society. It had always been a strong class-bound society. And he says, now for the first time in German history, we have a liberal party in Germany, the Social Democratic Party. Herr Ollenhauer got up after Dahrendorf had finished and said that that was an interesting speech by Professor Dr. Dahrendorf. But if, he said, if he were a member of the Social Democratic Party, he had been a lifelong member, he would know that the Social Democratic Party is not a liberal party. Well, I think Dahrendorf was more right than Ollenhauer. The political differences in modern democracy conceptualized since the French Revolution between the left and right remain. The Democrats and Republicans, the Social Democrats and conservatives still provide choices on the ballot, although their ideological bearings and internal factions are changing. Cleavages linked to stratification, of course, are no longer the only or the main correlates of left or right positions. Issues involving social morality, abortion, family values, civil rights, gender equality, multiculturalism, immigration, crime and punishment, foreign policy, and supranational communities move individuals and groups in directions different from those linked to stratification positions. But basically, most of these matters cannot be related to social ideology. There can be little doubt about the prospects for the continuation of the 200-year-old American political system. The Democrats founded under Jefferson have existed since 1796 with a base among the outgroups, the less privileged, the status deprived, and the less religious. The intelligentsia have been found in the non-business-linked party ever since Jefferson's Democratic Republicans. The more socially conservative, more business-oriented parties have had different incarnations, Federalist, Whig, Republican, with similar more privileged in-group constituencies in each format. The Republicans today draw on libertarianism and social and religious conservatism, as well as economic conservatism, comprehending classical Hayekian liberals. The meanings of the terms left and right are changing. As I've suggested, the parties of the left still identifying themselves, their names are social democrat, socialist, labor, have reconstituted themselves as liberals in the American sense, not the European sense. To this should be added their emphasis on post-materialist issues, environmentalism, equality for women, minorities and gays, and cultural freedom. The right has been moving in various degrees towards classical liberalism or libertarianism. One stresses group equality and economic security, the other equality of opportunity and the weakening of state power. Logically, the right should also support personal freedom along the lines favored by 19th century liberals and libertarian ideologists. The links, however, between the new economic conservatism and religious traditionalism in some countries, particularly the United States, have fostered cultural conservatism with respect to issues related to sex, family, and the style of life. Given the complex variation in the political cleavage structure, it is difficult to specify a consistent pattern differentiating the left and the right internationally. And I'm going to suggest this, there's a great deal of confusion across the Atlantic in understanding the words that we use, such as neoconservatism. I don't have time to go into it, but it's a concept which I think has been given a meaning in Europe and in Britain, which is quite different from the meaning which it has in the United States. Well, all this should make for more conservative and smug societies. Yet the standards by which Western countries now judge themselves are derived from the French, American, and Marxist revolutionary creeds. These proclaim that all men, now people, are created equal. And the economic equality, of course, is still great, even increasing during periods of technological innovation, such as the present. But since patterns of deference of social class inferiority are declining or have declined, while communication mechanisms have opened to many are increasing with the spread of the internet, domination by the privileged, power has become more dispersed. And I think one can say about all of our societies that they're now less stratified, more egalitarian, and more democratic. But they still have democratic politics, and this means that they will continue to have differences between that one can conceptualize between left and right or liberal and conservative. Thank you.
Well, listening to Professor Lipset talk about the Soviet attitude to America brought back a joke to me, which is nearly 40 years old, when I was 40 years ago, when I was a postgraduate in Moscow University. And the joke, such as it is, was as follows. Radio Moscow has a program about America, and a listener rings in to say, I listened to your program, but I'm rather confused, because on the one hand, you say that America is standing on the edge of a precipice. On the other hand, you say that we're determined to overtake America. So my question is, given the fact that the basic issue here, certainly the basic issue in Professor Lipset's book, is why socialism didn't catch on in America, maybe I should explain that I personally have never been a socialist. I've never really been a Tory either, and now I'm a member of no political party at all, which means that I'm very well placed to reply to a lecture about something that didn't happen. What struck me about his book, which you'll all have to buy now, because Professor obviously didn't have time to go into all the evidence of American exceptionalism, but what struck me about his book was this simple question of why socialism failed so starkly. And the evidence he produces in his book is very detailed and enormously convincing. And he adopts a very original approach to his subject, because the most basic philosophical question of all concerns why there is something rather than nothing, whereas Professor Lipset has explained to us why there is nothing rather than something. Normally, historians and sociologists tell us why things happened the way they did, rather than why they never happened at all. Professor reverses that again. This is not the what-if school of history, this is the why-not school. In proving his negative, Professor Lipset is certainly convincing. After reading his book, it would be a bold man or woman who was prepared to argue the contrary thesis, namely that the victory of capitalism in America was a damned close-run thing. His reflections on the historical nature of American democracy and his exhaustive detailed evidence seem proof that socialism, let alone communism, never stood a chance in the United States.
Now, this raises the question of why so many highly intelligent people on the left of American politics believed that it did. And of course, the same question can be applied to the right. Why did so many otherwise level-headed conservatives believe that the threat from socialism and even communism was a clear and present danger? For such threats to evolve, there must be fertile soil, and as I read it, Professor Lipset's book shows that there never was, or at least not in the necessary depth or the necessary proportions. On the face of it, a lot of activists on the left and right of American politics have a lot of retrospective explaining to do. A compendium of their responses to his book would be fascinating. N.B. Norton Books, who published the professor's copy. An easy way to explain why socialism never caught on in the USA is certainly a lot easier than doing the awesome research Professor Lipset has done, would I suppose be to go to the other extreme and ask why it struck root in Russia. After all, a comparison between de Tocqueville on America and the Marquis de Custine on Russia, whose books were written within a few years of each other, showed us long ago that the two nations had radically different temperaments, one conditioned to freedom and openness, and the other to secrecy and autocracy. We must hope, incidentally, that there will not be a book in 10 years' time explaining why democracy never stood a chance in Russia. His final chapter is called The End of American Exceptionalism. Unlike the famous title of The Webs, which praised the Soviet Union as a new civilization, Professor Lipset has wisely retained an interrogation mark, which wasn't perhaps so much apparent in his talk, but it's there in the book. This raises, of course, the whole question which the professor touched on, of what the word exceptionalism means today, as distinct from when de Tocqueville used it. There is, of course, American exceptionalism, which means not being like Europeans. There is French exceptionalism, l'exception française, which means being as different from the Americans as you possibly can without damaging your self-interest. And, of course, there is British exceptionalism, which means that though others do their modest best, we are the only truly exceptional people around. So, whatever the homogenizing effects of globalization and the European drift across the Atlantic, we can be sure that exceptionalism in the future will continue to be the rule. The big question is, of course, can we conclude in the light of this, the professor's thesis, that there will never be any form of socialism in the USA? Instinctively, we may say yes, but in the remotest corner of my mind, there is a tiny speck of doubt. That would depend not just on economic circumstances, and people occasionally talk about the possibility of cataclysmic circumstances arising, but on whether Americans forever remain the same people. It seems to me that national personalities change for the worse and for the better, which incidentally gives ground for hope in Russia. Let me give a little local example of changing temperaments. Happened here recently. Not long ago, the people of Britain were saying, fatuously in my view, that the petrol crisis brought out the traditional Blitz spirit, failing to note that the blockade was a French-inspired tactic, and that by supporting it for the sake of a couple of pence off petrol, the heroic British people were blitzing themselves. My view on whether America will retain its anti-collective spirit is obviously that for the foreseeable future, it will. This year I've been to Chicago, New York, and Florida, and relatively speaking, they give the impression to the outside of streets running with gold. On the other hand, I always work on the assumption that a country which introduced prohibition is capable of anything. In a way, I really mean that. And when it comes to predicting the future of great nations, a little humility is currently in order. If our powers of prognostication on America are the same as they were on the future of the Soviet Union, then you can rest assured that America will be a centrally planned socialist state in some 15 years' time. Professor Lipset's arguments are so strong, and in his book so densely illustrated, that they bring out the contrarian in you, and one casts about for exceptional circumstances that might prove him wrong. It's admittedly a little bit futuristic, though perhaps rather less given the climate in the last few days, But should climatic conditions in America show incontrovertible signs of changing dramatically, I can see American politics greening up to an evangelical degree. If people in authority go into eschatological spasms and call for more social control every time someone smokes a cigarette, how would they react if freak storms and tidal waves stalk the land? Professor Lipset ends his book by saying that the absence of a viable Green Party seems to show that America remains as different from Europe as ever. But Ralph Nader, as I understand it, insofar as he can be associated with a left-wing tradition, looks like getting a respectable score. And if he does, I'll take a bet that he will be proclaimed the moral victor of the presidential elections. Though maybe that has been one of socialism's problems, too many moral victories, too few practical ones. Nikolai Berdyaev, one-time Marxist, said that the trouble with socialists is that they deify the proletariat but have no respect for work. And as Professor Lipset makes clear in his book, at least, in the European sense, America never even had a good class of proletariat. Thank you very much for your talk. I'm sure we all enjoy it.
Let's see. Do we have microphones that people can speak into? No? We don't. If you're going to make a comment, you're going to have to shout. Okay? Could you actually ask a question? Is it possible? Okay. If you didn't hear the question is about the relation of race to questions of socialism. This is basically the question you're putting in. Sit.
It's a good question and a very valid question. Actually, I deal with ethnicity and pluralistic social backgrounds as a factor, and this was something that Marx and others people noted as one of the problems of forming class consciousness in the United States, that American workers came from very different social backgrounds, that you had cleavages along racial and ethnic lines. And there are a number of factors of which that is one, which I think are in addition to what I call the major cultural ones, which is the anti-statism and American religion. I give more emphasis, as you probably know if you've seen the book, to the fact that American religion is different from religion in Europe. It's Protestant sectarian, individualistic, anti-statist, and very moralistic. But you know, there's just no question that race and ethnicity affected the probabilities or the possibilities. The blacks, of course, until the civil rights movement, the majority of them living in the South couldn't vote and didn't really take part in the polity. And it might be noted, curiously, that South Africa had a strong labor party at one point among whites, which was also a very anti-black party, but a party of trade unions, and so that the existence of the black-white, the different kind of a conflict in South Africa, didn't prevent class differentiation operating among the white community.
Yes. Here's a microphone for you.
Are you defining socialism too narrowly?
You have to turn it on.
Are you defining socialism too narrowly? Because I'm looking at
the history of the British left and the American left, certainly up to the 1920s and 1930s, there wasn't really a British Labour Party. There was a progressive alliance through the Great War, as there was in the United States. And American liberalism was highly attractive to large parts of the British labor movement in the post-war period. The fact is the American left, it may not have had a socialist party, narrowly defined, but it had a very inventive, innovative left from progressivism at the beginning of the century through Roosevelt up to the present. And isn't there a danger in defining it too narrowly that you overlook the nuances mm-hmm. and the enormous influence on the British left and probably on the mainland European left that the American liberals and progressives have had in the 20th century?
So if I could just rephrase your question, you're asking Professor Lipset whether the left and socialism, formal socialism, shouldn't be distinguished, and whether this is too narrow a measure of the left.
Well, I am saying that the existence of a party which calls itself socialist is not the only way of defining and describing the problems of exceptionalism.
Mm-hmm. Can everybody hear this?
The enormous influences on the cultural politics.
Could you bring this back?
No.
All right. Go
right.
Ahead.
No. It's a good question, and I, of course, I would agree. First, you know, what one. You defined there's all sorts of socialist movements and socialist theorists, and hence, you know, you can argue that any given conception of it is not the right one if there is any such thing. But still, the American left, you know, one of the things that I emphasize in the book is the anti-statism of America, which derives in part from the revolution, which, and you know, Jefferson. That government governs least, which governs best, which governs least. But if you look at the American labor movement, the American trade and its conservative, in the American, the AFL, American Federation of Labor, led by Gompers, in a lot of labor history, is described as a conservative organization because it. No, I agree. I'm going to say it isn't. It was not a conservative organization. It had an extremely high strike rate. It committed violence. There was more violence, dynamiting, and so on by American unions than you found in Europe among the socialists. But what was the ideology of it? It was it was syndicalist, not socialist. And Samuel Gompers, who was its leader for 40 years, once when asked what his politics were, said, well, I guess three-quarters of an anarchist. Now, there was a revolutionary, a left-wing labor movement in the United States, the IWW, the Wobblies, the Industrial Workers of the World. But they weren't socialists, they were anarcho-syndicalists. So on the left you got a kind of anarchism, an anti-statist left, and on the right you got an anti-statist right. But the, you know, and in fact, you find American left intellectuals, Noam Chomsky is much closer to being an anarchist. He calls himself a Luxembourgian, a follower of Luxembourg. If you want to find a description of the United States in almost libertarian terms as an ideal, society, read C. Wright Mills, and like, it's not socialist, it's libertarian. And this, so that what you get is this anti-statism of the right and anti-statism of the left. And it continues down to the present. There have even been alliances between the left anti-statists and the right anti-statists. Chomsky's been in organizations with some people who are considered arch-conservatives. So this anti-statism, I think, is a very strong element in you know, preventing a socialist, and if you're willing to define socialism as necessarily involving use of the state for reform, part, if you define it as just anti, you know, as communitarian and without a statism, then you can say there have been a lot of such people in the United States.
Just 1 second. No. Yes.
Well, Mr. Lipset, since you painted that actually since the last 20 years, all the countries in the world are pursuing the same market-oriented government, wouldn't it be better then to abolish the complete concept of democracy?
I'm sorry, would it be better to do what?
Abolish democracy.
To abolish democracy?
Abolish.
Why?
Because everybody is pursuing the same
thing. No, but they're left. You know, they're left and they're right. You know, back in 19, I mentioned earlier H.G. Wells' book, The Future in America. And one of the interesting things he says in that book, which was reiterated a half a century later by Louis Hartz, was he said in the United States, this is as of 1906, he says there's no socialist party in the United States, but there's also no conservative party. He says both American parties, namely the Republicans and the Democrats, if they were in Britain, would be part of the British Liberal Party, the left and right wing of the British Liberal Party, and then as of that time. And I think he was basically right. Now, there's a left and a right wing. There's a part, you know, the Democrats are not the same as the Republicans. The Democrats support, you know, I could go in a whole bunch of issues and policies which differentiate Democrats and Republicans, so that, you know, we have a Democratic government, and what people want, the politicians try to reflect if they can.
Uh-huh. Well, in that case, I would like to add something, personal note, in a way. George Walden remarked that the fear of socialism is rather greater in the United States than, or the fear of the left, than the actual numbers of the left. And I think I'll just tell you an anecdote about this. In 1952, when my mother was indicted for sedition as a member of the Communist Party, she was hauled in by the FBI, and she had decided that she would tell them everything about herself, but nothing about anyone else. And this was a duel that went on for days, stretched into weeks. And the thing that stretched it out was when they asked her to tell them the number of people in the cell of this Communist Party in Chicago. She said there were six. They thought, well, she's obviously lying about everything. There can't be just six members of the Communist Party cell. And I tell you this anecdote only because, to me, one of the interesting things about the question that this book poses, and indeed it's a question that you, George, raise as well, is why, if the formal left has been so insignificant in the United States, has it loomed in the imaginations of those who are not left to such a great degree, particularly America, and particularly in the form of a kind of specter of disaster that's about to strike the society? And that maybe opens up another chapter in the history about the imagining of the left and the need to imagine the left, which can never be encompassed by left-wing activity. Well, I'm sorry, I just add this as a personal footnote. Can I thank, and will you join me in thanking both of our speakers for a really interesting and informative evening? Thank you very much. There's a reception on the fifth floor. I warn those of you who are not wary about this, avoid the LSE white. It's probably made of turpentine, but apart from that, please join us on the fifth floor for both the speakers.